Air Vita Insights.
Welcome to Clair Vita Insights with Alice
and Sophia,
a podcast where we get all the insights together. Today we'll be talking about vaccinations.
Let's dive right into a little bit of the history of vaccines. So the fundamental idea of vaccination, which is inoculation, where you inject a little bit of the disease or virus into you, that was in use way before modern medicine. But this was something more along the lines of variolation, where a small amount of the virus, or simply the viral matter, was introduced into the body. And what's really interesting is that the word variolation came from the word smallpox or variola, and that was really the first recorded use of variolation. So this was as early as 1022 AD, when a Buddhist nun would take smallpox scabs and she would grind them up, and then she would blow them into the nostrils of healthy people, and they would have immunity. And this method evolved in different ways, and it spread to the West, and it kept changing. And then in the late 1700s, vaccinations was introduced by Edward Jenner. So he wasn't the first one to experiment with vaccination, but he is often the most credited. So that's why we're talking about him in particular. So when he was an apprentice to a surgeon, he was very interested by the fact that dairy maids, they were considered protected against smallpox. And the reason why is that a dairy maid explained that she had cowpox, and so she'll never suffer from smallpox. And they're two very similar viruses, but they're different. And so he was really interested about this. So he dove a little bit deeper than others. And on May 14th, 1796, he inoculated James Phillips, which was an 8-year-old boy of a dairy maid who had had cowpox. And what happened is that he took the cowpox lesions or scars, a bit of the cowpox, from Sarah Nelms, his mother, and he did some cuts along James's arm, and he gave him the virus. And after experiencing some mild symptoms, the boy was inoculated again in July, but this time for matter of a fresh smallpox lesion or scab. And he experienced no symptoms. And so it was at this point that Edward Jenner deemed James Phillips as protected. And so he used this method for other people, and it evolved up until the vaccines we have now. So this is just a little scratch of the surface of the history of vaccines. And if you're interested, we encourage you to do your own research, maybe Google a thing or two.
Yeah, so while we're talking about the history of vaccines, when I was actually doing some research for this, I found some information about mRNA vaccines compared to traditional vaccines. So this concept, it came around about 30 years ago, and the basic idea of it is that a virus has a center of genetic material. This could be DNA or RNA. And then from that, there's mRNA, which is messenger RNA, or messenger ribonucleic acid. So this mRNA, it creates a protein which forms a protective layer around the virus. The idea of traditional vaccines is that they introduce a bit of that protein into the body so that the immune system can recognize and defend against it. On the other hand, mRNA vaccines take the mRNA rather than the protein and introduce that into the body. So the mRNA will then produce the protein in the body so that the body can learn how to defend against it. This has actually been found to be more effective, as it helps the immune system so that it produces both antibodies and immune system killer cells. In the topic of COVID-19 vaccines from Moderna and from Pfizer are some examples of mRNA vaccines.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's really interesting how it's just like introducing it and then it just does it all for you. So yeah, this kind of relates to a couple of ways that we can stop a pandemic. And I mean like everybody on Earth, and more specifically, you know, the government. Yeah, society. Based on a TED-Ed video that I watched, it had some really interesting terminology that I decided to also use. And there are three ways to stop a pandemic. So the first one is to race through it. The second one is to coordinate and crush. And the third one is to delay and vaccinate. So, and there obviously is one that's the most effective, and we're going to get into that. But let me just briefly explain what all of them mean. So race through it is where the government or the people in charge, they don't really do anything, and they wait for herd immunity to be achieved by allowing almost everybody to get infected by this, and they will either get sick and survive and then they have immunity, or they will simply pass away, which is unfortunate. And the benefit of this is that the pandemic will end in a short period of time, but millions of people will die and healthcare systems might even collapse because of the an overwhelming amount of cases. So that's the first way. The second way is to coordinate and crush. And this is where all of the countries, all neighboring countries, they synchronize a response. And this includes restricting travel, quarantining, and social distancing. This method ends in a couple months, but it has a really high potential of resurging to pandemic level again, because a virus is rarely fully eradicated and it might have just passed on because of the fact that all the neighboring countries, they coordinated. And the last way is to delay and vaccinate. So this slows the spread. The goal is to slow the spread by testing, quarantining, shutting down things, and by physical distancing. And the goal of this is to give researchers time to research the virus and to create a vaccine. Over the next couple of years, when the vaccine is made and it is given to a large portion of the population, herd immunity kicks in and the virus stops, basically. Now, the downfall of this is that it is a longer process and it's stricter, and it's kind of where we're heading here in Canada, or where we're already at. So we kind of have personal experience with this. At the end of the day, that one is the best, the delay in vaccinate. So luckily, that is what we're doing right now, or it seems to be what we're doing.
So I think you touched on a really important thing that was herd immunity. So herd immunity basically, it occurs when a large enough portion of a population is immune to some disease or virus. So to become immune, you could, like you said, you could have had previous exposure to that disease, or you could also become immune through vaccination. The issue with becoming immune through previous exposure is that depending on the disease, it could be something you can catch more than once, or it could lead to lasting health effects, or it could even kill you. So in my opinion, I would rather be vaccinated. So herd immunity, basically when that certain percentage of the population is immune to the disease, it makes the spread of it from person to person a lot more unlikely, and therefore makes the whole population protected, not just those who are immune, but also non-immune people. This idea of it keeping people safe even when they aren't vaccinated or something, that's a really important thing, because there's some people who may be like immunocompromised, people who might be like too young or too old or have underlying health conditions, they might not be able to be vaccinated. And therefore they still need to stay safe. But if that certain percentage is reached, then they can be protected and they can be safe from this disease. Yeah, so herd immunity is also a bit of a difficult subject, because it, depending on the disease, it has a different percentage of the population that must be immune to reach herd immunity. So for example, the measles is a highly contagious disease, so about 94% of the population must be immune, which leaves only 6% of people who can be unvaccinated. So far for COVID, there hasn't been a percentage found for herd immunity, but researchers at Johns Hopkins University say that the herd immunity threshold for any virus can lie between 50 to 90%. So somewhere around there is how many people have to be immune to coronavirus for the cases to start dropping.
Yeah, I heard a statistic recently. I'm not sure if it was Canada-wide or Ontario-wide, but it's like how 50% of adults were vaccinated already. And I think that's really good.
That's great. I have my appointment in less than a week.
Ooh, exciting, exciting.
Very excited.
So yeah, we're both really excited to be able to get our vaccine. I'm too young. as of right now, but hopefully
Child.
in the future. But yeah, that kind of brings us to a point where, you know, there's often a common misconception in the health and wellness community, where health and wellness practitioners and companies, they only believe in homeopathic medicine. And this isn't necessarily true. For example, Alice and I, we believe in science. You know, we believe that vaccines are very important to society, to people, to protect everybody. And it's not just natural medicine that can, you know, stop a pandemic, that can stop, you know, viruses, illnesses. Like, for sure, they might help. Of course, they might help. But we believe that vaccination is the only way that, you know, things can go relatively back to normal. So yeah, there are many reasons why somebody might be hesitant to get a vaccine, or why they might be completely against the idea of getting a vaccine. So we think that it's important that we bust some myths. So quite a common myth is that vaccines cause autism.
Yeah, I have a lot to say on this subject, but I'll try to be a bit calm. So this whole idea of vaccines causing autism, basically it's just untrue. Like that's the sum of it. Is it was some study done by a man named Andrew Wakefield, and he was a British surgeon. And he conducted this study to find if there was a link between vaccination and children developing autism. Autism can be caused by genetics and or environmental conditions. It's not fully known what causes autism, but it can't be caused by a vaccination. There's so many studies which completely refute the findings of Wakefield's paper. But Andrew Wakefield, he conducted this study and he published it in 1998. And because of how widely spread this study was, because it was in a scientific journal, people were intrigued by this and other people did research into this. And then they all discovered that his findings didn't match anyone else's, which then led people to wonder how he got these answers. And it ended up with his study being discredited for numerous reasons,
which included serious procedural errors, financial conflicts of interest, and ethical violations.
Wakefield then lost his medical license and his paper was retracted from this journal. There's also a whole issue of, would you really rather your child die because they aren't vaccinated rather than them be autistic? I think that that's such an awful thing, that you would rather your child be unsafe and unvaccinated than have them have autism, even if it was true, which again, it is not. There's also like a whole issue between the link being found, because children at a certain age that they would be getting vaccinated would also be around an age where the signs of a child having autism might show up. So again, that's just,
you know, correlation, not causation.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, another myth that seems to turn up a lot is that natural immunity is far better than vaccine-acquired immunity.
So as I mentioned earlier, if you have natural immunity to something, that means that you've come into contact with that disease or with that virus. And coming into contact with that virus could be a really serious issue, because like I said earlier, it could cause serious medical conditions, or it could even kill you, or you could get the disease more than once. So becoming vaccinated really is just the smarter option, because then you don't have any of the risks that you would get from
natural immunity.
Yeah, for sure.
An example of how dangerous catching a disease could be to acquire immunity We could go back to measles. So if you contract the measles, you have a 1 in 500 chance of death from the symptoms. Whereas if you look at the vaccination for the measles, the number of people who have had severe allergic reactions from this vaccine is less than 1 in a million. So it's just so much safer and so much less likely to cause you harm to be vaccinated rather than to develop natural immunity. A third myth about vaccines is that vaccines could infect the child with the disease that it's trying to protect against.
So I think this myth comes out of, when you experience symptoms after getting a vaccine. So vaccines, they can cause mild symptoms similar to those of the disease that they are protecting against. But when these symptoms do occur, and it's very rare, it's like less than 1 in a million cases, this is actually the recipient's reaction to the vaccine itself, as opposed to a reaction to the disease. So there's really no reason that you should worry about it causing the disease because I think there was only one vaccine and it was the oral polio vaccine, I think, and that one isn't even in use anymore. So that's why there's no reason to worry about the vaccine giving you the disease that it's trying to protect against because the symptoms, they're just from the vaccine, they're not from the disease that it's protecting. So I just wanted to touch on the fact that we understand that there is a wide spectrum of people who aren't necessarily against the vaccine. There are people who might be solidly anti-vaccine, or they might be more along the lines of vaccine hesitant. So for the remaining portion of this episode, we are just going to touch on how to lead productive conversation with people who are vaccine hesitant, because it's more likely that you can, really touch a person, not like physically touch, but a person that's vaccine hesitant because they're not against it. They might just doubt it. They might be the third round of people who take the COVID vaccine as opposed to the first round. Just to see what happens. So some ways, according to the UN Guide to COVID Communication, and this is about COVID vaccines, they say that you must understand why they're hesitant. What is the fear? What causes it? And it might even be systemic issues that happen to their demographic. So it's important to be sensitive around that topic. And there's also the idea that you should work with their moral values. Don't challenge their values. Instead, what you can do, you can use those values to make them support the use of a vaccine or to show them why they should support the use of a vaccine. For example, if they say, I love my family, you can say, well, you're protecting your family members who maybe are too young to get the vaccine or who are immunocompromised and can't get the vaccine. So, something like that. Another good way to communicate productively is to use simple, non-abstract terms. Experts, they kind of forget that not everybody knows as much as they know. And so they might throw around words like messenger ribonucleic acid or something. So where people are confused, they often fill this confusion with assumptions. Like if you don't know something, you'll just try to wrap your head around it, and then it might not be the most accurate way that you wrap your head around it. So that's why it's really important to use simple words so that there's no space for confusion. It's just right in front of you. Here are the facts, here are the benefits. So yeah, another important way is, who is addressing, vaccine hesitant people. It's very good for people who are close to this person, your doctor, like specifically your family doctor or a regular doctor you have, because, you're more likely to believe someone that's closer to you. Family members are also good people to address this topic, and even the local governments. Now, this is more likely like municipal governments or your community, And finally, there's the idea of evoking the right emotions and which emotions not to evoke at any cost. For example, you shouldn't evoke sadness and shame because this often makes people ignore the information that they are given so that they can maintain a positive sense of themselves. Because who wants to feel bad about themselves? So they're going to try to ignore it and, not see the true benefits. And another emotion to avoid evoking is fear. Because fear is often used, like, it's a good thing when the person is directly affected. For example, if it's in their community, you might make them scared and say, and then they'll be convinced to get a vaccine. But if it's not in their community, it'll do the opposite. It'll immobilize them. Because, you know, fear is only helpful, mostly helpful when they're directly affected. But it'll immobilize people because it'll make them less engaged to the issue. Because again, it ties back to the idea of wanting to maintain a positive sense of self. And also, you know, nobody wants to be scared all the time. So it's very important that when addressing people who are vaccine hesitant, to be respectful, understand why they're hesitant, you know, evoke the right emotions. So that brings us to the end of this episode. We hope you enjoyed.
Hope you learned some things.
Definitely hope you learned something. And if you are still curious about anything, you know, Google is a good place to start. Having conversations like this is really important.
Yeah, it really is. Thank you so much for joining us today. Stay safe.
Okay, bye guys.